Take a breath.
Would you like some water?
Or tea?
A glass of water would be fine.
So it's my great pleasure to welcome Andy Ferguson to Many Rivers Books and Tea for the first time. Stuart and I, of course, have had the pleasure of interviewing and actually one of our former co-radio interviewers on our show also interviewed Andy. So he's appeared on The Mystical Positivist twice. It was an amazing conversation with us and a great conversation also with our good friend who interviewed him before. But we found out much more about Andy's work in interviewing him on our show than I had known before, in addition, of course, to his well-known book, Zen's Chinese Heritage. And we were just discussing how in the world did that go out of print and when is it coming back in print? You can maybe answer that question.
Zen's Chinese Heritage?
Yeah.
Still in print.
It is still in print? Well, oh, okay. I didn't see it. Is it Through Wisdom, the expanded edition? Okay. Then we'll have to get it in Through Wisdom.
They told me as long as I was alive, it would be in print.
Oh, all right. Well, then I stand corrected, and I'm delighted to hear it, so we'll get that back in. Also, Tracking Bodhidharma, which someone has just purchased, but she has generously allowed it to be examined, this copy to be examined during the evening in case you want to order one to pick up at a future date. But in addition to that work, Andy has led tours to Buddhist pilgrimage sites and other sites from Zen and Buddhist history in China. He has worked with climateprotection.org. He's has an engineering background, a language background, and a definite bent towards philosophy as well. And that, I think, is part of what we'll be hearing about tonight. So please join me in welcoming Andy Ferguson to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
So I'm really happy to be here tonight. And thanks for the great introduction, which was a very accurate introduction, by the way.
Yes.
Covered most of the bases. The reason that we decided for me to come here this evening and talk was out of my last radio interview. We spoke about my book, Tracking Bodhidharma. And in that book, I discussed the fact that it had led me in a certain direction of research. And what that book is about is, first of all, Bodhidharma, for probably most of you know, is the ostensible founder of Zen Buddhism in the world, or especially in China. And that book is about me pursuing the historical roots of Zen Buddhism in China and finding the places where it started and whether or not what the local stories were about it and what the old literature had to say. And what I found was something very interesting, that it gave me a new perspective in that there was a lot of Zen in China before Bodhidharma came there. And so why was he declared to be the first ancestor or the first patriarch of Zen? It didn't make any sense, because I could tell from the literature that there were lots of Zen masters stretching back a long time before that.
When you say a long time, Andy, how long?
200 years, really.
Before?
Yeah, before Bodhidharma. But the Zen idea was already well developed in China. And the main people that when Bodhidharma came there, some of his main rivals, you might say, the religious people who were thought to have persecuted him, were already Zen masters, were declared to be Zen masters for the emperors and things like that. So what was it about Bodhidharma that would set it off? Well, a scholar would be immediately suspicious in that and presume that there were political factions at work, that the political faction that ultimately won out was Bodhidharma's group. And so he was declared to be the first Zen master in China. The truth is a little bit more complex, but just as interesting, I think. Because in a sense, there was a real political aspect to Zen in China. And that came out in my book, Tracking Bodhidharma. What I pointed out was that there was an imperial Buddhism in China, that the emperors had adopted, made a political thing. And then there was Zen, which appeared to be a reaction against that. Because Zen didn't like doctrine, didn't like rulers. Bodhidharma famously did not meet any emperors in China except one legendary meeting with Emperor Wu, where Emperor Wu said, "Look at what a great Buddhist I am," and Bodhidharma says, "Well, I don't think you're a great Buddhist." And they went their separate ways. Well, that was a very telltale story, because what seemed to evolve out of that, and what I found in a lot of old literature that hadn't been translated yet, was that Bodhidharma apparently rejected imperial Buddhism, rejected Buddhism being absorbed and used by the leaders and the teachers. Subsequent to this, and this book goes into this, and it, by the way, that particular book leads to a very ironic ending, because Emperor Wu, who was declared to be the great Bodhisattva emperor and promulgated Mahayana Buddhism as a Bodhisattva, expounding the sutras, he sent some emissaries to Japan. Well, he didn't send them to Japan, but emissaries went to Japan from him, and they essentially created the Japanese state. They took Buddhist texts, and the Japanese had no writing materials prior to that. And Japan was fighting, they were fighting among the warlords there. And the Sogo clan latched on to this emissary from Emperor Wu's court, learned about this imperial Buddhism that Emperor Wu had, and used it to unite Japan. And united Japan using Buddhism as the political ideology. And Confucianism, by the way. Emperor Wu was famous for having both Buddhism and Confucianism. Well, what's Confucianism? Loyalty to your parents, loyalty to your sovereign, all the things that a feudal ruler would want to have happening. And then Buddhism was this nice gloss over the whole thing that made it all sound very peaceful and beautiful. So Japan was united with Buddhism as a political force. And so the irony, of course, is that Emperor Wu was in Nanjing. And his court was in Nanjing. And his imperial Buddhism was in Nanjing. And then during World War II, Japan's generals were mostly Buddhists, or a lot of Buddhists. And some of the main generals that instigated the war against China, actually, they were very much involved with the Lotus Sutra, and as apocryphal texts that would tell of the political rise of Japan as a ruling country for 1,000 years. And they invaded China, and they ultimately invaded Nanjing, and the Nanjing Massacre happened over the place where Emperor Wu originally promulgated this political ideology. So Bodhidharma comes out really looking great, because he said, you know, you get mixed up with politics and you're going down the wrong path here. This is not about that. And so I really came to believe, after doing a lot of this research and doing a lot of traveling in China, that Bodhidharma's real historical role, the reason he was loved, was because he rejected imperial Buddhism. He rejected the doctrines and the metaphysics that went with all that. And he said, no, go out and practice in the forest. I mean, it was kind of the original Buddhist ideal, in a sense. And if you go into the teachings of the Zen masters after that, one of the most important Zen masters was named Baijiang. His Japanese name was Hyakujo. If you've read any Zen stories, you've probably read quite a bit about him, because he started the Qingwei, the pure rules of the monastery, of the Zen monasteries. And famous fox koan, you know, of Hyakujo and so on, where a monk appeared to him and said, actually, I'm a fox, and I've been reborn 500 times in this fox's body because someone asked me a question and I gave him the wrong answer. So of course Hyakujo gives him the right answer, and he transmigrates out of the fox's body. Point is, Hyakujo is very famous, but if the part that Hyakujo that never gets translated in the text that you see today from Buddhism is the part where he says, do not follow the Bodhisattva path. The Bodhisattva, and essentially the Bodhisattva path is the way of the imperial Buddhism. And that should be eschewed. We should stay away from that. Which was quite shocking when I read that, because, you know, I'd been practicing Zen for decades. Nobody had ever quoted that passage to me. And so the point of this introduction is, I started getting a lot more critical about what was really going on with the Zen movement. I didn't lose any respect for it at all, because actually my respect for it was being enhanced through this understanding. I realized there was a lot more to it. It was a lot more interesting than I thought. And then there was this other aspect to it that we didn't discuss in my radio interview, which was Zen teaches, fundamentally, the old teachers in China taught about the nature of the mind. And Bodhidharma famously said, point directly at the human mind, see its nature, and become Buddha. That was his famous saying. And if you read my book, Zen's Chinese Heritage, you'll see that that's the dominant theme in all the old writings. One teacher after another would talk about the nature of the mind, what it was, and the fact that beyond this understanding, there is no Dharma to teach. There is nothing. And in fact, even this understanding can't be called a real Dharma, because the nature of mind is just consciousness. So how are you going to teach that? It's only experiential. So the odd thing about that teaching is, I realized, was that it was this traditional Western teaching called idealism. Radical idealism is that Bishop Berkeley and those people that taught mind, there's only mind. These Western philosophers, that Western tradition. Well, is there a connection there? How did this Western idealist tradition get dropped in the middle of medieval China? It was very strange to me. I couldn't understand that. I could see that there was this separate thing that looked just like the Western tradition of understanding that mind, there's mind only. And there are Buddhist schools, by the way, called mind only school. The mind only school. So then I read a book by a scholar named Thomas McEvely several years ago. And that completely changed my understanding of what was going on. Now I had already been looking at this, trying to understand the nature of the teachings and the nature of the mind and whether it was Western or not. And then Thomas McEvely, who was a Greek scholar and a Sanskrit scholar, and he spent 30 years studying both the Greek history and the Sanskrit history, and he wrote this, his magnum opus was this really thick book called The Shape of Ancient Thought. And in this, he talked about how when Alexander the Great conquered northern India, or northeastern India, what's now Pakistan, Waziristan, Afghanistan, he had philosophers with him. And those philosophers, around 325 BC, one in particular named Pyrrho, encountered early Buddhism, very early Buddhism, and were deeply impressed by it, apparently. At least Pyrrho was. And Pyrrho came back to Greece teaching essentially the doctrines of the Buddha. And what's quite fascinating about this is that actually his account of Buddhism from 325 BC, at the time of Alexander the Great's conquest there, is by far the earliest reliable account we have of Buddhism. The normative Buddhism, the Buddhism of the texts and the sutras that we've seen or studied, didn't even get written down until what's called the Kushan period, which was about 200 or 300 years later. So in other words, the earliest historical account we actually have of Buddha and his teachings comes through a Greek named Pyrrho. Yeah.
Is there any relationship between what you're talking about right now and the questions that came in the
end? Yeah. I can get to that in a minute.
Okay, sorry.
So, well, why don't we talk about that? So there's a famous text in the Pali Canon named Questions of King Milinda, or King Menander. And in that text, which that was one of the first texts I ever read in Buddhism. I think I was 17 when I read it, because I got one of those books on, all about Buddhism, and one of the chapters was Questions of King Milinda. So who was he? So Alexander conquered northeast India And he left huge colonies there. And he didn't just conquer it. He left. He went back and then died in Babylonia, 6 years, 7 years later or something like that. And he had already conquered Egypt, and he went all through the Middle East and went off clear to northeastern India, went all the way up to a place called Taxila. And he set up 9 cities in northern India, all of them named Alexander, of course. And one of them was called Alexander the Farthest. You know, it was the farthest place he went. It was right literally on the border of China now. And so the Greeks settled this area, and these Greek colonists, and then there was this migrations of people coming from Greece that came there and lived as a colony for centuries. And the Greeks actually dominated culturally a large area of that. In fact, there was something called the Greco-Indian Empire, in which the area of Bactria and Gandhara and these areas were actually Greek satrapies, essentially. Because when Alexander died, his generals took over. And by the way, Alexander, one key part of the story is that Alexander declared himself to be a god. And before he died, he was to be worshipped as a god. And one of the reasons why he got into a bunch of trouble with his own men was, they said, "You're a Greek." And Greeks don't declare themselves to be gods. And by the way, that's bullshit. And but the local, the Asians, that, you know, were kind of into that because they were used to regarding their rulers as kind of deities. Well, Alexander, you know, kind of got with that. Declared himself to be a god, and then his generals, when they inherited these different satrapies when Alexander the Great died, declared themselves to be gods. So this went on with these Greek kingdoms were controlling Bactria, northern India, the Greco-Indian Empire. They went back and forth, but mostly it was a heavily Greek culturally dominated area. And in the middle of this was the Mauryan dynasty, what's called the Mauryan dynasty. Back up a minute. Before the Mauryan dynasty, no, about the third, I'm forgetting my timeline now, but in that milieu of Greek culture was King Milinda. And so King Milinda was a Greek. I didn't know that when I read Questions of King Milinda. I just thought he was some Asian king. And then I was reading this book by Thomas McAvilly, and he said, well, King Milinda was a Greek. And by the way, there's people in the audience. It refers in the text to the 500 Yonakas in the audience. Those are Greeks. The word comes from Ionian. They were Ionians. And so the entire audience was full. So I went back and got this text that I last read when I was 17 or something, and opened it, started studying it, and I realized it was basically a Socratic dialogue. The king was interviewing the monk, Nagasena, and he says, "Monk, so what's it about?" So the monk is lecturing him on this idea of emptiness, sort of, what is a cart? Is it the wheel? Is it the axle? Is it the cart? And it's all of those parts. Well, where's the real cart that we're talking about? And so it was kind of this metaphysical thing. But every time that they would have an exchange and the king and the monk would get the king, like a point of the argument, the audience would go, "Hey, king, he's got you now. What do you have to say about that? What do you think about that?" And I realized that was not an Asian audience. Those were Greeks. Asians would never do that. No text I ever read would anybody ever challenge the king on, "Hey, he's got you in the argument now," like it's a debate. Never read that in an Asian text. Yeah.
And this was happening in Alexander the Great's cities or outposts in northern India?
Yeah. So Melinda or Menander was the king. He was a Greek. And he adopted Buddhism ostensibly because of this debate with Nagasena, the monk. And he declared himself, like all kings, he took power ruthlessly and killed a lot of people. And then he declared himself to be the savior. And what's interesting is that then the succession of Greek kings in this area declared themselves to be saviors. You know, I mean, that's how you control the population. I'm this spiritual savior. But the more fascinating thing was, in this era when very early developing Buddhism, there were some other very interesting points. One of them was that there was a Greek monk at that time, very famous, and he marched with something like 100,000 other monks from what's now Afghanistan down to Sri Lanka to bring the Dharma to Sri Lanka. And they crossed all of... Now, this tells you something right there. Tens of thousands of monks are going across India, taking the Dharma to Sri Lanka. India must have already been ready for it. I mean, India must have already been ready to support these monks. There was already, obviously, a flourishing Buddhist culture going on, and the Greeks were running it. The Greek monks, who were the ruling elites, were doing it. So when I started...
Yeah. So these monks were ethnically Greek?
Ethnically Greek, yeah. And so, Bodhidharma, blue eyes. He was known as the blue-eyed barbarian. So in China. So, so this pretty much stood on its head, my whole understanding of how things developed up to that point. And then what Thomas McEvely did, this scholar who studied this so deeply and knew both Sanskrit and Greek, ancient Greek and ancient Greek history, he started tracking the parallels between the cultures and the influences. And it turns out that some of the stories that I translated in my book, Zen's Chinese Heritage, actually came from Greek folklore. For example, there's a famous phrase in Zen Buddhism in China. He was deluded, thinking that he saw a piece of rope in a well and thought it was a snake. It was a specific phrase that recurs a few times in Zen literature. And it was McEvely that pointed out in his book that actually comes from this ancient Greek parable. It's an ancient Greek parable of someone who's deluded and looks at a piece of rope in a well and thinks it's a snake.
But that also comes from the Vedic literature, too.
Could be,
yeah. Wouldn't that predate it? And wouldn't that be how it would get to Buddhism from India? Because the Vedic literature is far older.
Well, there's some debate about that. The Vedic literature claims to be far older, but there's no actual written literature that indicates that it is. That's traditionally everyone has assumed that, but scholars have really
Vedic literature was in existence when the Buddha arrived. He arrived into a Vedic culture, in existence then.
That's the story that everyone has grown up with, but many scholars now believe that aspects of the Vedic literature, they have no writings from that era. All they have are much later writings. Mm-hmm. The earliest writings that we have of the Buddhist, of anything in India, of anything at all, is only 100 or 200 BC, about 100 BC. Mm-hmm. So you have centuries and centuries before that. And so we don't know really what was going on. Of course, in China... Now, some of these scholars argue, for example, and I'm beginning to think that they have something to their argument, that Taoism was actually early contact between Buddhist teachings in China, you know, pre-written historical records in the court in China. And then this is etymology, you know, in terms of the word structure, they argue this because early Taoism sounds just like early Buddhism. And then, if you actually look at the words and the original pronunciations of the word, like Tao is like Dharma. And, you know, the word comes from the same etymology. And they point out, and then there's these weird inconsistencies in the Taoist canon, like Lao Tzu rode off to the West before he died. He left China and went off to the West, to the Western frontier. Well, why did he go to the Western frontier? They say... We think it's because he wasn't a Chinese to begin with. because Lao Tzu, the word Lao Tzu is not a Chinese name. It just means the old one. And there is no Chinese ethnic name associated with that figure historically. So the surmise is there was a lot of communication going on that we simply don't know about. Not a lot, but there was communication going on that we simply don't know about. So is that true or not? I don't know, but there are scholars, Christopher Beckwith is one who argues that very fervently, yes?
Well, I was going to mention that, the Greek Buddha, that new book that came out. But it seems that the interesting thing about Firo was that his thoughts, his what he wrote, did not come from Greece. Nobody, supposedly, this is what Beckwith says, no? That it was so foreign, and the only place that he could have gotten it, because he was with Alexander in that part of Asia, you know. So
yeah, so yeah, his book, Hero, the Greek Buddha, is that it?
Yeah. It's just called the Greek Buddha.
The Greek Buddha, yeah.
And that book
argues a lot of what I'm talking about here, I think. Because in that book he talks about how he went with Alexander the Great to India, and then he had these revelatory experiences when he met the Sramanas, the Buddhists in India. The word Sramana was a very early word for Buddhist home-leaving monk, and it was well known in Greece. That word Sramana was known in the Greek language, recognized as being a Buddhist practitioner in India. And then that same word exists in Chinese as shaman. Shaman, like a shaman almost, but almost the same pronunciation. So I think that there was a lot of going on that we don't, you know, a lot of things are lost to history. So bring this back around now to the theme of my talk tonight then. So when you look at this situation, especially when you look at the development of... Let me make one more point on Firo before we leave him. And that is, one of the stories about him is that he was kind of favored by Alexander the Great, and then he wrote something that praised Alexander. Alexander had the biggest ego to match his reputation. And Alexander gave him 10,000 pieces of gold while they were in India. And then the Indian Sramanas, the Buddhists, criticized him, or somebody did, by implication it was the Sramanas, who said, as long as you're dancing at the court of the king, you're not doing anything. You're not practicing anything that means anything. So even at this very early point, there was this divide between the imperial, the court, and all that, and what the practice of the Buddha was, which was to go off and leave the world. And you can't mix those up. So that's a reflection of what I talked about earlier with Bodhidharma and Emperor Wu. So to bring this back around to the theme of the talk, I ask the question, well, if this is all a case, and what you find in Imperial Buddhism in Asia are these metaphysical doctrines which were very part and parcel to what the emperors were teaching. And what are those doctrines? The doctrine of emptiness, the doctrine of Dharma Dhatu, you know, Buddhist metaphysics, Buddha nature. You know, these doctrines that we've read about for years by reading Dogen and other teachers, but these are associated with Imperial Buddhism. And they were not accepted uncontroversially in China. There was a famous Chinese scholar named Tang Yong Tong, who lived in the 1940s, very brilliant. He wrote a very big book on that deals a great deal with how Buddhism was accepted and developed in China. And he gives accounts of riots in the streets of Buddhists who refused to accept the concept of Buddha nature. They said it's a violation of Buddhist teachings. It implies that there's something permanent and so on. And if you look at the development of the doctrines of the sutras, you realize there were two paths. One path was the Nirvana Sutra, the original account of the Buddha's death. And the other was the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, the great entering of Nirvana Sutra, which was a metaphysical document which said, not only, I mean, all those teachings I told you before about Anatman, about there not being a soul and there's not being, you know, those were all for, you know, just lesser teachings for people who don't get the real thing. The real thing is that there is a soul, it lives forever, and you should be, you know, and it's a, you know, it's encompassed in these metaphysical doctrines that go on and on. Part of my original suspicion about all this was when I was reading these two different things ostensibly about the same event, which is the Buddha's death, and there were two really different stories, and one of them was clearly a lot of metaphysics and that kind of thing. So if you have this baggage, metaphysical baggage, that was rejected by the Zen school, by the way, and one of the hallmarks of Zen was they rejected these ideas. But it was carried on as a political force, because these, for example, let me give you an example of what was going on when Bodhidharma lived. When Bodhidharma was alive, in the northern part of China was the Northern Wei Dynasty, and the emperor had declared himself to be the Tathagata, the Buddha, and he rewrote the precepts himself, and anybody that wanted to become a monk took the precepts on his ordination platforms. In the south of the country, you had Emperor Wu, who was the Bodhisattva emperor, as opposed to the Tathagata who ruled northern China, and he was expounding the Mahaprajnaparamita Sutras as to convocations of 10,000 or more next to Bell Mountain in Nanjing. These two great Buddhist monarchs were constantly at war with each other, you know, killing each other and carrying on. And so this was not unusual. Prior to them, the Buddhist imagery, for example, at Dunhuang, the great caves out in western China with all the great Buddhist figures, those caves were originally where monks were living who were serving the caravans on the Silk Road. The Buddhist monks would sit in the caves. Then they'd probably go out and sell some charms to the people trying to get their silks and gold back and forth over this unbelievably long and treacherous trade route. And they'd sit in their caves somewhere, and it had built up to a very big community. And then that's actually one of the local Chinese rulers of what's called the Northern Liang Dynasty who said, you know, Buddhism was starting to really develop as an ideology, and he took it, his ruling ideology, and he went into the caves and put figures of himself in the cave. And he said, yeah, there's Buddha over there, and then here's the me, I'm the Bodhisattva. And you say, you should be worshipping me too. You know, that was Maitreya. So the whole cult of Maitreya seemed to evolve out of these rulers who would put their own statues in the caves where the Zen monks were sitting meditation. And they would invade and take that space and use it for their own political purposes. So this constant struggle, contradiction between the monks, who were presumably authentic religious practitioners, and the rulers who were trying to usurp the religion and use it to legitimize their own rule. What you find is from very early times until the 20th century with Emperor Hirohito, this was the same story all the time. They were constantly declaring themselves to be Maitreya or the Savior or something, and countering that all the time was this positive religious, positive spiritual development, which I think is represented in Chinese tradition primarily by Bodhidharma, and that's why he got the title First Ancestor. And so when you, but the strange thing is that if you accept these accounts that Pyrrho was the person who brought this skeptical He's regarded as the father of skepticism in Western philosophy, essentially. There were skeptics before him. Remember, he was, if you look at his pedigree philosophically, Alexander the Great studied under Aristotle. Aristotle was a student of Plato, and Plato was a student of Socrates. So in other words, you have three generations of philosophers going back from Pyrrho, and you have Socrates, and Socrates, of course, was, I don't know anything except that I don't know anything. So there was already this skepticism going on in Greek culture at that point. It's not like this was new, but nevertheless, Pyrrho developed these doctrines of not knowing to the point where he is regarded, widely regarded as the father of the skepticism school in Greek philosophy. It developed into different branches that disagreed with each other. There were the academic skeptics and then Pyrrhonian skeptics, and they were different. But the point is that this skeptical philosophy was attributed to Pyrrhon. Now, if you go forward now 200 or 300 years to the time of the Roman Empire, or about 100 BC or so, 100 to 200 BC, skepticism based on Pyrrhonian thinking was revitalized, came back again. He kind of got lost in the shuffle for a while because there were a lot of, you know, Aristotle and the Aristotelian school and Plato's philosophy developed as the academy. The academy grew and developed. But finally, Pyrrhonian philosophy came back with a great resurgence under the writings of a Roman philosopher named Sextus Empiricus. So Sextus Empiricus said, this is the Pyrrhonian school, and this is what we teach. It's this school of skepticism. And this became very popular in Roman intellectual thought. And one other school became very popular at that time. And that school was called Neoplatonism. So Plato's teachings also developed, and that school really ultimately developed as a teaching on the teaching of the mind, the nature of the mind. The same thing that you see when you look at Zen Buddhism with Mazu and those people. They were teaching mind is Buddha. You know, beyond mind there's nothing else, and so on. And this was essentially the teaching that encompassed Neoplatonism. So you have this really interesting situation now, because now if you look at the Roman Empire at around 100 BC to the time of Christ, the Roman Empire extends very deeply into India, its influence, because there are trade routes now plying back and forth through what's, you know, Arabia, going up the Indus River, and an enormous amount of trade. And some of these areas where the Romans are trading, there's already Greek colonists in India. I mean, the descendants of Greek colonists. Greek culture is there. And they're reading these books. They're reading these books by the Neoplatonists. They're reading the book Sextus Empiricus, and so on. So Neoplatonism has the three modes doctrine, and in that doctrine it says that consciousness is composed of three aspects, and the aspects are, roughly speaking, normal consciousness, like I'm here, you're over there, and that's the way it is. And then a second one where you realize that actually there's no modulus, there's no center of any of that. There's just this field of consciousness, and that's all there is. If you try to look deeper for a soul or any actual existence of a self, it doesn't exist. You can't find that. You can only see this field of consciousness, and that's a realization around that. And that can be roughly associated with the fundamental Buddhist teaching of co-arising. You know, the idea of the co-arising of all phenomena without, I'm not going to get into that. You've done enough Buddhist reading probably to understand it better than I do. The point is, and then there's a third aspect of consciousness, goes beyond that. And those same three aspects are almost identical in the teachings of Neoplatonism and in the teachings of 7th and 8th centuries Zen Buddhism, possibly earlier. Probably earlier. So what you have is this strange thing when you look at it and analyze it. It's possible, so let me throw out some of the possible reasons why this could be so. That Nagarjuna, Asanga, and Vasubandhu, who are the principal Indian philosophers that we think of as expounding these philosophies, were Greeks.
Wait, are you declaring that?
I'm not declaring it. I'm proposing that it be considered.
Proposing that?
That Nagarjuna, that Asanga and Vasubandhu were actually Greeks. Because Asanga and Vasubandhu very much taught doctrines that are in line with Neoplatonism that was prevalent at about the time they lived from Roman influence. And, yeah.
Yeah. Neoplatonism, so you have the Enneads and you have Harmonious Sakas. And he had Christian influences that are connected to the Neoplatonism. And the early Christians went up to India through the Indus Valley. So mm-hmm. there's a strong association with all of that, even with Christianity.
I think so.
And as far as the source of the consciousness, the latter part of the Enneads talks a lot about the light. I think the light, interior light, is actually the source of consciousness. And I think the Enneads would very much point that out.
Yeah. We don't have a good understanding. We don't have a very good understanding of how all the thought influenced each other, but it looks like it was really extensive. Yeah.
And to follow up on that, I was just listening to a lecture by Robert Thurman, and I think we have to take into account what was going on in the culture, and that doesn't necessarily mean someone was of a different culture. That is, in the Indian culture at that time, with Nagarjuna and Vasubandhu, the culture was not what we know of as today. It was a hugely diverse mixing of lots of threads. And because those threads were there mixing them, doesn't say that, therefore, this guy had to be Greek.
No, I'm not saying that they definitely were. But the things I would point out is... Yeah, there's no reason to think that that was impossible, because we know that the Greeks were a ruling elite for a long time, and the culture was very dominant. The Gandharan Buddhas are Greek figures. The first figure of Buddha that we know of that appeared with a guardian deity, he appeared as Apollo, and his guardian deity was, Heracles. So we don't to say that they were separate is harder than to say that they were deeply enmeshed with each other and influencing each other. And I don't think anyone disputes that Buddha himself was, of course, I have no reason to think that he wasn't pretty much like he was described historically, And he clearly influenced Pyrrho. But then what could have happened was that those philosophies that influenced Greece so much, Thomas McEvely argues in his book, The Shape of Ancient Thought, is that early on, Greece was very heavily influenced by India, and that the rise of various movements in Greece could very likely, early philosophical movements, could have been rooted in Indian culture. We don't have direct evidence of it, but we have some indirect evidence. And it's just too much of a coincidence to think that it happened like together, So there's a lot more going on like that. But what we know about the Greek colonies was that the Greeks tended to be amongst the ruling elite. They conquered the place, and then they had a lot of land. And even if after the Greeks lost power, direct political power, their culture remained very strong. The coins that showed the different Greek kings through that era, Mauryan dynasty, Greco-Indian empire, the coins showed the kings displaying a mudra. So these Greek kings would strike coins and they would display the Vitarka mudra on the coins, as you know, Greeks, and then they would also be wearing headdresses that indicate that they had conquered India and stuff like that. And the developmental period of Mahayana Buddhism just was right in this era. Now, we don't have very much good evidence about what happened at that time. We see a lot of evidence that the kings were assuming the proto-Buddhist symbolism. They would declare themselves to be saviors, which is like a bodhisattva. And then we know from Chinese historical records that after the Kushan dynasty, which is around 100 to 200, or about the time of Christ and thereafter, in that era, with King Kanishka, we know that these political forms became very entrenched. And when the Chinese brought the doctrines into China through the translations of some of the early monks, the rulers in China specifically directed people to translate the sutras that would support imperial Buddhism. So they translated a lot of sutras about Maitreya. So there's a real indication that Maitreya was a very early, and there are Greek figures of Maitreya. So a lot of the Gandharan statues depict Maitreya as a Greek. So you have to me, it just speaks to the fact that from a very early time, the same thing happened to Buddhism that's happened to every other religion on the planet, which is that the political class appropriated it and started to evolve doctrines and stories and other things that would serve their purposes. And there was always a dynamic conflict between true home leavers, the real sramanas, and this political class that stretches all the way back to what we can see in Pyrrho when he was criticized for accepting a gift from Alexander the Great. What I know from reading Chinese historical records is that this was a really strong movement in China from the beginning. We know that from those are well-known stories, we don't think about them very much, but Kumarajiva, the great translator of sutras, was forced by the king of China to marry and to have children, for example, because that's what the political class does, you know. He was from he came from this area that the sutras had developed from Kushan. He was a Parthian. There was a Parthian kingdom that was very developed Mahayana Buddhism very much. So what you see is, in my opinion, is that from a very early time, or relatively early time, Buddhism was politicized. When it got to be strong enough so that the rulers couldn't let it operate independently, you know, that's when they take over. And that was certainly the case in China. And I saw that again and again in Chinese history because, for example, in the Zen school with Bodhidharma, there's no indication that there are big indications that Bodhidharma didn't want to have anything to do with emperors. It says in these ancient texts that he traveled around China and his followers were like a city. But the ones who wanted him to come see them, namely the rulers, couldn't get him to do it. And then, if you go down through the next traditional Zen ancestors, the second ancestor, third ancestor, fourth ancestor, and you can visit all their places in China. We've done it many times on my tours. The stories around them are stories of people that would not go to the court. They wouldn't go see the emperor. Second ancestor was literally persecuted by the Buddhist establishment and killed, executed, thrown in a river. His body was thrown in a river, floated upstream, and somebody got it out and buried it. And he became unknown. And then the third ancestor had similarly obscure, non-court thing. And then the fourth ancestor, it's the most important one, Gao Xin, the emperor decided that Buddhism was really getting out of control, and he declared that all the Buddhist teachers in China had to come live in the capital. And so Dao Xin said, I'm not going. And so the emperor sent an envoy out to tell him he had to go to the capital. And each time he'd say, I'm not going. Everybody else can go. One of the people that went was the Oxhead Zen master, you know, the Oxhead school. They all went to live in the capital, but the fourth ancestor refused. Finally, the fourth time the envoy said, he said, this time I'm instructed to either bring back your whole body or just bring back your head. So which is it going to be? And so, you know, the fourth ancestor said, well, go ahead. You know, I'm not going. I have to take the head back. So this was actually a very seminal event in Chinese history, very well known. And I think it's really had that same anti-imperial thing I'm talking about. The Zen school refused to go to the capital. And it was, this isn't even a point of debate among scholars. I went to a scholarly conference on Zen in China about 5 years ago. And all of the main storyline of the main scholars that were there was, okay, who would go to the capital and who wouldn't in the Zen school? And when you look at who went to the capital and who didn't, the ones who didn't became the famous ancestors. The ones that went to the capital became the northern school. You know, the ones who don't understand the real teachings of Zen. You know, the other disciples of the fifth ancestor who went and taught, like you know, Shenxiu. The ancestors who lost the poetry contest with Wei Nung, the sixth ancestor. So there's this huge political theme under all of it. And I propose to you that that theme has been with Buddhism from the beginning, more or less. Ever since Buddhism got big enough so that the rulers cared about it, they developed doctrines, they tried to appropriate it. And in China, the story is very interesting. It's probably a book that should be written for greater or wider access. But with Zen, it appears that when the fourth ancestor would not go to the capital, that the emperor at that time was named Taizong, and he was a really pretty ferocious guy, known to be very headstrong, but really smart. And he's considered, the Chinese who love their imperial history consider him one of the greatest Chinese emperors. But he tried, and Zen was clearly, and he was having problems at that very time with rebel movements in the area of the fourth ancestor's temple. So he needed to keep everybody under his thumb. He couldn't get him to come to the capital, so what did he do? Can't beat him, you join him. He started extolling the Zen school, how wonderful it was. And I think there's a fair argument to be made that Bodhidharma and the second ancestor and the third ancestor and the fourth ancestor would never have been known had it not been that Taizong decided that he was going to have to extol this school in order for everyone to follow him, to see that I'm with you, Zen is great. You know, I'm going to honor you by giving you the purple robe of spiritual greatness and so on. So you see this political narrative, and then when you go back and actually look at the second ancestor's temple, and you dig into the old local records, you find that it was created at that point during Taizong's rule. During the fourth ancestor's time was exactly when Taizong declared the second ancestor to be one of the great Zen ancestors. And the place where he was buried became a recognized temple, imperial temple. So what does that tell you? It tells you that this political narrative went on constantly in Buddhist history, and Taizong, by the way, the same emperor, was the one who declared that we should all now chant the Heart Sutra. The Heart Sutra should become part of our liturgy. And he chanted it at his death, and it was chanted at some people before he died, I believe. A couple of scholars have written about this, Jan Nattier. And what's interesting about that is that if you go back before that time, that the Heart Sutra was not accepted by the primary Buddhist movement that you know, supported Zen Yogacara. Yogacara teachers did not advance the Heart Sutra, the Parashnaparamita Sutras, and it was Taizong's intervention because...
That's true. You're talking about in China.
In China.
Not necessarily in India, though.
No, but we don't. I don't think anybody really knows what happened in India around a lot of these questions.
There were Sanskrit versions in India.
There were Sanskrit versions going back, without a doubt.
But you're talking about China.
Yeah, in China itself, and one of the great. What amongst the schools in China? Remember, no one should be surprised that these religious schools were political animals. I mean, you know, so what? I mean, everybody knows that in the Middle Ages, some Christian king would adopt some Christian sect or have his favorite abbot. The point is that, and I make this point very strongly in my book about Bodhidharma, I don't think it's a coincidence that Mahayana Buddhism almost perfectly is described geographically by the snow zone in Asia. Where the snows are and where it's really cold. I don't think that that's a coincidence. And the reason is because Mahayana Buddhism, in my opinion, developed so many imperial things. Like the emperors would take it and they would say, well, now we're going to have the Maitreya Sutra about the savior that will come and save you. By the way, that's me. You know, put my figure here in the cave. There was so much politicization. And the reason why it took hold so strongly in the snow zone was because real Shramanas, real home leavers, basically only had two places they could live in the wintertime. It was so cold. They could either live in a cave or they could live in a monastery. Those were pretty much the choices. I mean, you could, in southern India, you could probably make it in the woods through the rainy season or whatever. But if you were in that cold place, it was really, really, really cold. And if you didn't have a nice cave somewhere, you pretty much had to go into a monastery. Well, who pays for the monasteries? It's always the king. The king and the ruling elites ultimately have to make enough wealth available to build the monastery. And if they build the monastery, the person who's going to be running that monastery is going to be supporting the doctrines that are going to support the ruling, the king as Buddha and so on. So this happened. I can't say what happened in India because we don't really know very much. The earliest writings we have in India only go back to 100 BC or so. But it's clear that in China, I'd be completely convinced reading the old Chinese records that repeatedly they would translate sutras and basically create sutras to support the ruling ideologies of the houses there. Happened started with the Liang Dynasty Emperor, the Southern Song, Northern Wei, Southern Liang, and it spread right to Japan. And when it finally went to Japan, it went almost entirely as a political ideology. So in plop Zen now in the middle of this, remember what I said about the Zen school. And in Zen temples in China, I would point out to people that they're constructed around the idea of the three natures of the mind. This doctrine that also is in Neoplatonism. When you walk into a Zen temple, traditionally there were three halls, main halls. First one, the Heavenly King's Hall, was the hall that it described right in the classical Buddhist literature what it is. It's the hall of worldly concerns, protection of the nation, you know, all the kinds of things that you don't associate with a home leaver living in the woods. More like, these are political ideas. And then the second hall is the Buddha hall, which represents this enlightenment as to the nature of consciousness, for lack of a better description. And the third hall was the Dharma hall. And the Dharma hall was where the monks would go, and there were no statues in that hall. There were no representations of consciousness. The front hall had Maitreya, was always the leading figure, surrounded by the heavenly kings protecting him. Then the Buddha hall would have the Buddha, and then that Amida Buddha, and then the Medicine Buddha evolved to have the Bodhisattvas and so on in that hall. But the third hall, even the Dharma hall, never had anything. And that kind of went along with this Zen and Buddha's idea of signlessness, of no marks. And this corresponds almost perfectly with this Neoplatonistic idea of the nature of the three natures of consciousness. So, so back to Pyrrho, you find that his influence as a skeptic was, it went down through history and had various levels of influence, but he was generally regarded as the father of skepticism. And then comes the Reformation in Europe and the writings of Sextus Empiricus, in which he had written the philosophies of Pyrrho, of Pyrrhonism, get republished because they had been saved in Arabic like everything else, and somebody translated them out of Arabic back into this the proto Reformation and then Renaissance intellectual ferment that was going on. And lo and behold, the writings of Sextus Empiricus suddenly had really big influence on people. They came out, a British scholar at Oxford or someplace wrote about this extensively, and his book was too expensive for me to buy. It was like $80 or something, so I could only read the outlines of what it was about. It said that in that book he describes how Pyrrho's philosophy really came out and developed again, and how it influenced things. And then, if you look at actual people that we know that Sextus Empiricus's writings influenced, we know who they are. And the most important figures amongst whom we know who they are Descartes, David Hume, and Montaigne, figures who, if you've read any of them, you know that their writings just are dripping with skepticism about Europe at that time. And like Descartes especially always strikes me, because like everyone else, you read him in college or something, everyone reads, Cogito Ergo Sum and all that. But his other writings are quite striking, because he says, all these teachings that people are expounding strike me as a lot of metaphysical nonsense. They don't make any sense. And what do we really know about them? We don't know anything. And then he goes into this dialogue, which is very skeptical about the whole thing. He says, I'm very concerned that all these teachings are not really based on what we can actually know. And that's where he gets,
Descartes dissected the mind, and he thought that the pineal gland was the center of the soul. That was his own statement.
I don't know everything about Descartes, but what I've read is his writings on where he describes the nature of teachings at that time in Europe. I mean, that's the thing that riveted my attention. And he says that if you go through the university, there's a lot of people expounding a lot of doctrines, but we don't know any of it for certain. And so some people regard Descartes as the father of modern science for having said that. That's one of the things that people regard him as having been, because he brought this real skepticism toward all the metaphysics that were being expounded by the theologians. So is that contrary to what you've read about him? I mean, I know that he had some other kind of stuff that was goofy, but I don't know what all that stuff was.
Well, when he saw the two, I'm not a scientist, so I don't know all about the brain, but I know that when he dissected the brain, the two lobes, and then when he was up at the top, he saw this one little part up at the very top in the center. He's wondering what the heck it was. And the pineal gland, which is the center of metaphysics, or people who are enlightenment, as you call it. So that was, I know that he declared that that's what he thought it was.
Okay.
That's where if there is a soul, that's where he associated it to be.
Okay, maybe so. I mean, a lot of those people who we regard as the father of modern science also had really some ideas that we might not necessarily agree with, or maybe we would, but the point is that he's generally regarded, I think, as the father of the modern scientific method because of his skepticism. Does anybody have contrary to that?
You're both describing the same phenomenon.
Same thing. Okay.
A guy who's going to cut up brains and say the soul is in this brain is a skeptic of theological ideas of the soul.
I think so. Yeah.
It's material. It's got to be here in the material somewhere.
Yeah. Okay. So, and probably even more influential in terms of Western philosophy was David Hume. And David Hume wrote a book called, or a treatise, I'm not very great on Western philosophy, but I do read it before I fall asleep at night. I've done that most of my life, so I forget most of it by morning, but he did write a treatise on human nature, or upon human nature, something like that. And in that treatise, it's one of the first things where a Westerner clearly, I mean, he's brilliant. If you read David Hume, you might, man, this guy was really smart. And he describes almost perfectly this teaching of no essential nature. If you look into human nature, you don't find anything there. It's empty of inherent nature. And he describes this very clearly in this writing he talks about on human nature. And it's such a very incisive, skeptical approach to the nature of the soul and that kind of thing that's in complete contrast to the theological arguments and all that. It's so anatman, you know, it's so kind of a Buddhist thing going on that's quite striking. And the thing that's striking about David Hume was he's probably one of the top five most influential Western philosophers that ever lived, wouldn't you think?
Did you see that recent article about Hume's connection to Tibetan Buddhism through a monastery in France?
Right.
You want to tell more?
Yeah, well, I'd like to hear about that. What is that about?
You know, I don't know where I read it.
A woman wrote a story about her kind of own breakdown.
And that Hume saved her.
She went to study about Hume, and in getting all fascinated by Hume, that can help her put the pieces of her own life and emotions back together.
Yeah, so she started really following Hume's life, and she discovered that there was a man that had been in Central Asia and had studied, I don't know what day, but
priest.
Many, many, many years, a priest,
yeah.
and was influenced by people that were heroists, still in Central Asia, in Middle Ages someplace. Mm. And then he went to this monastery in France, and Hume went to that monastery just a few years after this monk died. And so what really influenced her and brought her wish to live again somehow, because she literally claims that Hume saved her life, is because Hume's ideas were
derived.
Tainted by this priest that had been in India, or more like Afghanistan, more Central Asia, and that had been influenced by hero, you know. So there was a very sort of a modern article, but about how Hume saved my life, right? I think it might have been in the New York.
That's astonishing,
story.
Actually. I've never heard that story.
It's in the Atlantic.
Yeah.
It was in the Atlantic?
Yeah.
David Hume helped me solve my
Your life. It's really.
That's terrific. I get it. It's in the Atlantic, huh? I'll get that.
I have a link here.
That's astonishing.
Because it was, the priest had gone. I thought it was more Tibetan area, but regardless of where it was, there was a theological hegemony over which branch of the Catholic Church got to send their priests there, whether it was the Benedictines or the Jesuits or whatever. And the priest that was there first and had learned Buddhism, his side lost, and so he was recalled back, and then he retired at this monastery in France.
So this was like a failed Jesuit or something. Not a failed Jesuit, but somebody who had been like a Jesuit and came back.
Yeah.
And got converted the other way around.
Yeah. And he wrote about his what he had learned about Buddhism, and apparently it was deposited in this monastery. And she posits that the guy he told his life story to was the head of this French monastery, and that Hume would often take long walks with this guy, and so she says must have learned about this recalled monk or priest from the guy who was, because it was only just a couple of, you know, a couple of years, 10-20 years earlier that the guy had died. So the man that Hume was talking to as his host at the monastery when he stayed there was the man who knew the fellow that came back from.
Okay, well, there's a lot of interesting threads there that would be fascinating to know more about.
Yeah.
I mean, the Catholic Church, Lou Lancaster, you know, the head of Buddhist studies at Berkeley, always, you know, used to talk about the fact that the Catholic Church declared Buddha to be a saint, and he wasn't decanonized until like 1926 or something, because the Catholic Church used to go out and, you know, you couldn't convert all these people, so you just take their god and declare him a saint, and then they're automatically praying to the right person. You know, that was the way to do it. It was this wholesale salvation going on, and so that's what the Catholic Church. So these Jesuits apparently went out and had this contact, like you're talking about, and then that had real influence on church doctrine, apparently, and so that could have been part of the connection, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, Thomas Merton must have gotten his connection to Buddhism from other Catholics too, at some point.
Mm-hmm. So the connection with Pyrrho might have been more direct with the Middle East with Asia than just the writings of Sextus Empiricus, then, possibly.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't know. We don't. The story's a little fuzzy. We don't really know. You read that Hume was influenced by Pyrrhonism, but you don't know why exactly. Maybe he had some direct contact with it. So, when you look at that, and then you look at the fact that Descartes was influenced by this, so I guess, you know, the next question is, well, does this skepticism that gave rise to the modern scientific method, does it have its roots in this? In this type of attitude? Because up to that time, the theological attitude was what dominated. And in order to reject all that and be apart from views, you know, that's a possibility, I guess. That was really what I wanted to say tonight, is that if you look at this idea of Pyrrho and his influence, you know, you wonder whether the real heritage, the heritage that we got through Asian Buddhism, was a lot of politics in religion. Even in Tibetan Buddhism, there were so many groups that were vying with the lineage of the Dalai Lama for political power, and there was struggle around that. And that's everywhere I've looked in the writings in China, that politics has been there with Buddhism and fighting around it. So, and when I looked into the Zen literature, and a lot of people will use my book as a reference book for teaching Zen, because it's just a translation, and there's a lot of raw material there that people can interpret and talk about. But I personally have never heard anyone point out some things to me about those writings that struck me when I did the translation work, which was nobody ever talks about bodhisattvas hardly in the Zen tradition. I mean, up until the late Song Dynasty, bodhisattvas were not part of the picture. And nobody talks about the Heart Sutra much, except Dongshan disparages it at one point, and a couple other people kind of disparage the idea of bodhisattvas. But, you know, you kind of think, well, that's just those Zen guys. They were, you know, they were iconoclastic, and they didn't like to talk about that stuff or something. But actually, when I read the part from Baijiang, the famous Zen master, that said, don't follow the bodhisattva path, and don't follow the practices that support it, then I started to get suspicious that there was more to this than I thought. That Zen had a political nature of reacting against what the imperial doctrines were, that I hadn't considered. And so that skepticism toward metaphysics and refusal to accept metaphysical ideas was apparently a pretty strong political reaction in China to things that came out of the Kushan normative period of Buddhism. That's what it looks like.
I'm thinking of Baizhang's, you know, the place where that I know of, he says he flatly rejects the 10 bodhisattva stages. And he says, from him, his point of view, there's 3 stages. There's the beginner, the medium, and the complete. And in relation to emptiness, he says, the beginner abides in emptiness, the medium person does not abide in emptiness, and the complete stage has no concept of not abiding in emptiness.
Has no concept of any abiding whatsoever.
Yeah.
There's a better quote by Baizhang, actually one that's even more telling than that, that I used to show a slide on when I give talks about Baizhang. If you've got my book, Tracking Buddha Dharma, here, I can show you, I can read you the quote. He pretty much lays it down as a complete Pironian. He says, thanks for coming.
She's the owner of that book,
oh,
by the way.
Oh, you own this? You want to take the book with you?
She bought it, and she's going to come back tomorrow and get it.
Oh, thank you. He says, I've just about got him in the Baizhang part. But I guess I'll just paraphrase it. He says, they're having no views whatsoever is the fundamental view, and you should not adhere to any views, including not adhering to any views. I mean, basically, he just quotes pure all the way down the line, and in the end, he says, "And having no views is the fundamental view, and that's that, and that's all you need to know." And he's very he says it with no ifs, ands, or buts, that this is the only way, that the only correct approach. And it's essentially just this real Pironian kind of interpretation. Now, I'm not saying that there was a connection with Piro there. I'm just saying that whatever that philosophy was, and he says you don't have a view about emptiness, you don't have a view about, you know, anything. You just leave all that aside. And that's pretty much exactly what Sextus Empiricus says, when he says that you just suspend any belief in any view. You don't take any view. But you do live life according to custom in your time, and according to your own society. So,
I know we don't have anything left of Perrault's own writings. I've heard Stephen Batchelor talk about a student of Perrault, there's writings of a student of Perrault, but I didn't go remember his
Timaeus name. Of
has fragments of what Perrault, yeah. But that's the closest to his own writings that we have.
Yeah, we have Timaeus of someplace was his pupil, and he quotes him as offering that idea.
Well, how does it go from there to Sextus?
Well, we don't know that exactly, but Sextus apparently had a lot of sources on Perrault that we don't.
Yeah.
And he claimed that he was the true expounder of Perrault, so, you know, maybe he wasn't, you know, I don't know. But a lot of scholars think he was. I mean, the Greek Buddha book, offers whatever evidence there is, quite a bit of evidence.
There's a section in which, at the beginning, the effect with lists like the 3 main points of view of Perrault, and then that they, in the ancient Greek, he names them, you know, and then the 3 marks of Buddhism. Anatman, Anicca, and Dukkha, you know. And they're really, I mean, I don't know where he got that list. And is it a translation directly from Greek or, you know, and then the Buddhist, of course, is just the basic three marks of Buddhism. But it's remarkably, they're not in the same order, but basically it's the same main principles.
You know, it occurred to me once about 25 years ago, I was at Zen Center at Green Gulch, and we were having some kind of Saturday Dharma event, or we were broken off in groups, and we were talking about, I don't remember the nature of the conversation, but it occurred to me that I thought, wait, really what we're talking about is the scientific method here, of this skepticism and not being willing to, you know, just accept that this is, you know, some metaphysics about it, but actually being skeptical, this approach. And I raised the question, I said, what's the difference between what we're talking about here and like the scientific skepticism? I don't see why there's a difference in any of that. And my question was ignored, and we went on.
But not ignored here tonight.
Yes. So thanks very much. We've really gone late.
This has been a wonderful conversation. I want to thank Andy for coming tonight. It's been awesome. I want to point out that we have a donation bowl over there that we can urge you to contribute to, and we share that with our speakers to further their work or work they wish to support, and also retain half to maintain this space for further such events in the future. And, of course, there's some books here. Unfortunately, not Andy's book anymore, but we'll get more copies, believe me, and of Zen's Chinese Heritage as well, since now I realize I can get it directly
I'm
through.
I'm trying to clean up my garage, so before you order any more, let me bring some.
Oh, well, I'll be in contact with you then. that would be good.
Which edition is it?
The newer one.
Yeah, that would be the one we'd get anyway. Yeah. So anyway, thank you all for coming tonight.
They do have maps.
I've got that fancy map framed on my wall. Not the one that came in the book, but the one that you
got
from me a couple of years ago.
Got it. Nice. Well, thank you, Annie, and
thanks
thank
a lot.
You.